Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney. The program is a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. We are hearing a lot at the moment about a problem that is so foreign to most Americans' experience that it seems incomprehensible that it might be looming in our future. It's described in various ways, but food insecurity captures the idea. In some places around the world, in the wake of the invasion of Ukraine by Russia and the ripple effects that it's created, and a number of other factors that are operating at the moment, which we'll be talking about with our first guest, we're looking at a world in which there may not be just insecurity with respect to food, but famine. And it remains to be seen whether such a horror might be inflicted upon the American people as well, at least some of us. A man who has been studying this closely in recent years is our colleague and good friend, Lieutenant Colonel Tommy Waller, United States Marine Corps Reserves. He is these days the Director of Infrastructure Security at the Center for Security Policy, and has been specializing in various vulnerabilities that our country faces, which might be exploited by hostile powers. This one is emerging as a very serious new vulnerability, and we're anxious to catch up with him. Tommy spoke to a group in Washington, D.C. yesterday about this problem, and I want to pick his brains particularly about what he learned as well as addressed in the course of that conversation with specialists in the agricultural space. Tommy Waller, it's good to have you back, sir. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank, for having me on. Yeah, it was an honor yesterday to be with the American Agri-Women. Their slogan is a force for truth. And so no better fitting slogan for that organization right now when it comes to the truth that food security is national security.
I want to get to the truth, Tommy, because we're being told a lot of things that don't seem to quite add up. And one of them is that there has been a series of accidents at food production and processing plants across the United States, a spate of fires, even a couple of airplane crashes that have taken down some of these facilities. What are your, you know, sources telling you is going on here? Is this all, as we've been led to believe, a matter of coincidence and sort of normal operational problems, or is something else going on?
Well, Frank, first of all, I'm very glad that at least it's being covered in the news. Now, I think that there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that the fires, and at the moment, what I have is 30, the number 30 major fires over the last 16 months. These are the reason that they're hitting the news is twofold. One is that most of them are huge. They are catastrophic fires that are doing immense amounts of damage. And the second reason it's hitting the news, which is a good thing, is that people are beginning to pay much closer attention to the food and agriculture industry and issues that could curtail food production, distribution, consumption. And so one of the you know, difficult things is to try to ascertain, is this just accidental? Is there a malevolent piece to it? I don't have an answer yet, but it's something that I think needs to be investigated. And so one of the things that, you know, I do want people to understand, the food and agriculture industry does experience fires frequently. You think about food production, food is a fuel. I mean, when we eat it, it fuels our body. And so when it comes to being a fuel for fire, it's absolutely the same case. And so, you know, the National Fire Protection Association, NFPA, put out an article last month. Now, the title of the article didn't help anything when it comes to assuring people that this is not malevolent. The article's title, it was "Nothing to See Here." But they did explain that there's, you know, in 2019, 2,000 fires that year in the overall food and agriculture industry. Part of what I'm trying to look at is patterns. is the size of these fires. In terms of determining how they started or whether there was criminal intent, that is a difficult thing talking to fire investigators, because most of the time they won't undergo a detailed investigation unless there was some clues that it was malice. And so the point, though, Frank, I think is, thankfully, Americans are waking up to pay attention to this. We hope that they'll wake up to protect this infrastructure.
Yeah. Tommy, let's talk about some of the other factors that are contributing to what seems to be an impending, very serious food shortage problem, to say the least. I mentioned Ukraine and Russia. Both are exporters of large quantities of grains. Give us just a sense of what an impact the war in Ukraine has had so far and is likely to have going forward with respect to those two countries' exports.
Sure. Yeah, Frank. So, you know, when it comes to our food and agriculture sector, there, as you know, there's numerous forms of warfare, right? So what we see in Ukraine right now is kinetic war, actual kinetic warfare. And so, for example, over the weekend, Ukraine lost its third largest grain terminal to a Russian missile and air attack. So this is a place that would be storing and exporting grain to the rest of the world, and now it's in ruins. It's going to take years to rebuild that. That is kinetic warfare. The other downstream effect that you have is as the world witnesses this conflict in one of the largest breadbaskets of the world, countries begin to take precautionary measures, and you can't blame them for doing it, where they stop their own exports to make sure that their population is going to be okay. So you see countries like India stopping exports. You see China stopping exports. The first downstream effects, Frank, are going to be in North Africa, in the Middle East, and in Europe. And you and I both know that these are places that are already in many ways threatened by conflict, particularly that of the jihadi stripe. So you can bet that you will start to see much more kinetic war, people fighting over resources to avoid famine in these parts of the world. That will also affect the security of the United States.
Yeah. I'm glad you pointed this out, Tommy, because one of the things that I think, again, not thank God, having had much experience lately with serious systemic food shortages in this country, is how catastrophic it can be on a sort of civil society, an ordered society. If there simply is starvation taking place, people are desperate and they will do whatever they need to try to get their hands on food. And that can bring down governments and has all of history, I think it's fair to say. The Chinese are another factor in all of this. You mentioned them, Tommy. I understand that the Chinese have hoarded immense quantities of food, which again raises a question whether they anticipated something happening that was going to be disruptive of the food supplies. We only have about a minute, so just give me 30 seconds on that. We'll pause and we'll come right back.
Sure. Yeah, Frank. The Chinese have a lot of people to feed. We know, we've read their book, Unrestricted Warfare. We know that the Chinese Communist Party, from its inception, has used food as a weapon, that millions of Chinese citizens have starved in the past. And I don't put it past the Chinese Communist Party to use food as a weapon against the rest of the world, just the same way that we've seen them weaponize a virus and the response to that virus to expand their totalitarian control.
Hold the thought, Tommy, because all of that is subject for further conversation about what the Chinese Communist Party is up to and how food warfare might figure into their ultimate objective, which is to take down the United States and become the world's dominant power. We're under no illusion about that, I hope. We're going to talk about that with Tommy Waller and more right after this.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last August, Joe Biden failed to deter the Taliban's final assault in Afghanistan. In fact, his conduct and odious orders to the U.S. military to cut and run in the middle of the night, leaving $83 billion worth of advanced weaponry behind, not only assured, but effectively invited the jihadists' victory there and whetted their appetite for more elsewhere. In February, Team Biden once again communicated its unwillingness to impose appreciable costs, this time for a Russian invasion of Ukraine. Vladimir Putin responded, like the Taliban. Now, as communist China prepares for war, the Biden administration is clearing the way for U.S. investors, including federal government employees and military personnel, to put their money in China. It's also easing Trump-era tariffs, further generating revenues that not only signal our provocative weakness, but actually will help pay for China's aggression. Had enough? This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're visiting with Lieutenant Colonel Tommy Waller, United States Marine Corps Reserves, in his non-military capacity as the Director of Infrastructure Security for the Center for Security Policy. I'm very proud of our partnership there. Tommy Waller is a man who has studied closely issues involving the critical infrastructure and needs of our country, notably, and I hope we'll have time to talk a little bit about it, that of our electric grid, the most critical of critical infrastructures. But we're talking with him about a focus of immediate attention from him and his team, namely food insecurity. And Tommy, you were just talking about the Chinese Communist Party waging unrestricted warfare and it being perfectly possible that with the food that they've hoarded and the shortfalls that are emerging, including predictably, thanks to what their ally, Vladimir Putin, has done to Ukraine. This may give them considerable leverage on countries all over the world, including on us. And if bent on, as they seem to be, dominating the entire world, this could be very useful indeed. Let me ask you about one other piece of all of this, Tommy, and that is that also there are disruptions of fertilizer. I saw over the weekend urea fertilizer specifically, which is an ingredient for something called diesel exhaust fluid, which evidently is a critical source of combustive fuel for diesel trucks that have been essentially regulated into requiring such fluid. If they don't have it, trucks grind to a halt or maybe can operate at 5 miles per hour. And there seems to be a very substantial threat that there will be real disruptions as a result of lack of supply of urea fertilizer and the transport thereof. Give us a feeling, if you would, of how fertilizer shortages are likely to figure into both the costs in a moment of acute inflation, as well as the availability of food, and for the, that matter, transportation to get it to places.
Sure. Yeah, Frank, food and energy are completely interconnected. The production of fertilizer depends on the energy industry, industries such as natural gas. Anytime the United States curtails its own domestic energy production, that is going to have a downstream effect on things like fertilizer. Of course, it's going to have a downstream effect on things like transportation if we're not producing our own fuel for that. But we also, as you mentioned, we depend on urea, which is then, of course, put into this DEF, this diesel exhaust fluid. And look, this is not my words, but the end of April, Shamir Konar, who is the CEO of Pilot and Flying J, talked about, in his words, the possible catastrophe that could come if there's
absolute catastrophe, I think were his exact words.
Absolute catastrophe. That's right. And this is something I think needs to be investigated, Frank. Why would Union Pacific Railroad impose a 26% service reduction in Pilot's ability to transport DEF via rail? I don't have an answer right now. I don't think there's a good answer right now, Frank, honestly. But it comes at a time where we need our trucks to be transporting. We need our tractors to be breaking ground and harvesting. And so, you know, we've seen it before where very, very powerful corporate actors in the past have manipulated products and markets for the sake of profit. I mean, I can't tell you that something like that's going on right now. What I can tell you that if such a thing was happening, it could have a severe effect on people's lives and of course, their livelihoods.
Yeah. And that's really what this comes down to at the end of the day, isn't it? That we may see literally survival on the line in lots of places. What's your current projection, Tommy, as to how acute the empty shelves and inadequacies of food might prove to be in this country at the moment?
So we talked before about Africa and Europe are going to probably get hit first. We are very blessed in the United States that we have an abundant ability to produce food. But, I will say, and this is something that I thanked the ladies last night, the American agri-women. They represent just 2% of our country's population. 98% of us depend on them, on the farmers. And most people are aware that the farms are nowhere near the population centers. And so there's a situation where we take for granted the ability to go to the grocery store and get food, kind of the same way we take for granted flipping the light switch on and lights coming on because of the U.S. electric grid. And so what I worry about are all of the vulnerabilities associated with this magnificent system that allows our country to feed 330 million people with only 2% of its population. That major system is vulnerable to economic warfare, of course, sabotage and kinetic warfare, cyber warfare. We've seen a 608% increase in malware attacks in the food and agriculture industry from 2019 to 2020. And of course, the fact that all of it relies on electricity, and we currently do far too less to protect our electric grid, are reasons why I am very concerned about the nation's food security. And so, Frank, that's why we're doing a report on it. The report is called Food Security is National Security. We hope to have that out this month. And, of course, your viewers would be able to do a deep dive into all these areas and get an idea of what it is that we're concerned about and what we think needs to be done about it.
Great, Tommy. This will be available at securefreedom.org. Tommy, let me just come back to the grid situation because you've spent a prodigious amount of time warning about the vulnerabilities of that piece of infrastructure, as I say, the most critical of all, because without it, none of the other critical infrastructures can operate. When you look at what is both the current vulnerability and what we know we could do about it, Tommy, give us a sense of what it will take, as you see it, for us to assure that when we hit that light switch, we'll be able to continue to rely on it in terms of making the grid more resilient against these kinds of threats that could disrupt it as well as all the rest of those infrastructures, including food.
Well, Frank, it's going to take bottom-up action, ultimately. We're going to keep fighting this. This struggle from the top down. I mean, this Friday, I'll be briefing the Secretary of Energy again for her quarterly advisory board meeting. But by and large, the federal government has failed and continues to fail to protect the grid. And so this is going to have to go from the bottom up. I will tell you that in our Food Security is National Security report, I will have a case study. And this is something I hope will be an example to inspire local level leaders. I'm going to have a case study about an electrical substation, this one substation. I'm not going to tell you anybody where it's at, that supports a chicken processing, 650,000 chickens a day processed, a major dairy refrigeration and transportation and logistics hub, and two major regional grocery refrigeration and distribution hubs, all on one substation that's completely wide open, unguarded from any form of attack. And it's that awareness at the local level that's going to make the most difference so that those leaders and the electric utilities themselves can wake up and realize we're the ones keeping that industry going, and that industry is feeding America, so we've got to protect our gear.
Yeah. And I guess, Tommy, one of the other facets of this is if those industries that depend critically upon a single substation, a single unprotected substation most especially, were to join forces with, for example, our Secure the Grid Coalition, which you lead, and I really commend everybody to check out the extraordinary resource that it represents at securethegrid.com, we could see, you know, the pressure becoming irresistible to actually get the steps that have been long overdue taken to make our grid more resilient. And I'm also very encouraged, and Tommy, you've played a big role in bringing this about. There's a new documentary film by David Tice called Grid Down, Power Up that is going to hopefully become a vehicle for this kind of mobilization from the grassroots up. It's one of several new assets that will be brought to bear to educate the American people. Thank you for what you do in this regard, Tommy, not least our report on food security coming up, as well as, of course, all the work at securethegrid.com. We're going to turn next to another challenge, protecting Christians around the world. And our colleague, Dee Dee Laugesen, will be talking about what's happening in Nigeria and elsewhere right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and I am always ecstatic when I have a chance to visit with a colleague and friend of now many years, a woman who I've come to admire tremendously for her work on a whole host of issues that matter greatly to our country. Her name is Dee Dee Laugesen. She is the executive director of a group that I'm proud to be the president of called the Save the Persecuted Christians Coalition. She's also the executive secretary of another group that I work with, the Committee on the Present Danger, China. And her competence and acumen and energy in all of these areas and so many others is indispensable, I think, to the cause of freedom. So when we have a chance to catch up with her about some of the work she's doing, it's always a red letter day for us. Dee Dee Laugesen, welcome back to Securing America. Good to have you with us, Peter.
Hi, Frank. Always good to be with you.
Thank you. This subject that I wanted to talk with you about is not good, of course, and that's what makes the work you do so vitally important. Persecution of Christians is taking place around the world at an unimaginably large scale. Give us a sense of the magnitude, if you would, and where it's happening and why.
So, Frank, Open Doors USA every year puts out a preeminent report on the persecution of Christians worldwide. It's called their World Watch List. And this year they report that 360 million Christians are heavily persecuted in the 50 countries where it is most dangerous to be a Christian. That doesn't account for the numbers in other countries. So it is far greater than that. This is a 67% increase since we started our work back in 2018. And nobody seems to be alarmed by this or or addressing it whatsoever.
Yeah. Didi, this is, I think, indisputably the most egregious human rights abuse in world history. I mean, you can look at the various horrific communist regimes and the millions of people they've killed, the Nazis and so on. But the scale of this, now not all of these people are being killed, thank God, but they're all being, as you say, heavily persecuted. And that can mean torture, that can mean rape, that can be being stripped of their property, driven from their home, it can mean imprisonment, and yes, in some cases, it does mean murder. So to what do we ascribe this growth in the phenomenon, Didi?
Well, I really think that it's not a popular subject to talk about Christians who are being persecuted in the world. And you know, it's uncomfortable because 8 out of the top 10 countries that Open Doors reports on are Islamic republics. The fact of the matter is, Frank, that for more than 80% of those 360 million persecuted Christians, the driver of that persecution is Islamic extremism, the Sharia supremacists. Yeah.
Yeah. And where they are engaged in it, I think it's fair to say it's not simply as a fulfillment of what they believe Allah is directing them to do pursuant to Sharia. It's also an opportunity that goes back to Muhammad's day of, you know, raping, pillaging, and plundering people who have stuff that those engaging in this kind of persecution want. And this makes the question of, is there a place in the world where that kind of jihadist Sharia supremacist persecution is particularly egregious at the moment?
Well, of course, people know about Afghanistan, and Pakistan is one of the most dangerous places. But the one that is should be most pressing for the world is Nigeria. Nigeria is the linchpin of Africa. It is the most populous country by far, 200 million people, 50-50 essentially between Christians and Muslims. But in Nigeria, the Muslims are completely in control. They head up all security agencies, most administrative agencies, and the courts are filled with Muslims. And the Christians have been edged out. They have been marginalized in Nigeria for 20 years.
And they're roughly half the percentage, half the population,
yeah,
is that right?
Half the population, but nonetheless, with a Muslim is the president, and the Fulani are the tribe that he comes from. The Fulani Muslims are really driving the terrorism in Nigeria. You have two groups, the Boko Haram terrorist group working in northeast Nigeria, and then in northwest and the middle belt, you have Fulani herdsmen who are literally chasing Christian farmers off their lands. In the last 20 years, there's been some 100,000 people or more slaughtered by these raiding terrorists. They're all jihadists. They all would like to see Nigeria come under the rule of Islam and see the Christians exterminated. And some 3 million Christian farmers have been forced off their land. They can't go and farm the land, so this sets up for danger of famine. And you have major highways throughout the country that are not accessible because of the number of kidnappings that happen. Railways and airports have been attacked. And nobody is talking about this in the international community. Just this last month, a young Christian college girl was murdered by a mob on campus because she sent out a text that they said was blasphemous. They gathered around her, huge mob of Muslims gathered around her, stoned her to death, pelted her body, and then burned it. And there were more than 50 police officers standing there. They did nothing to stop the crowd. And Frank, only just this last weekend on Pentecost, a Catholic church in Ono, Nigeria, Ondo State, which is southwest of Abuja towards Lagos. So this is an area that has not seen this kind of violence before. During church services, at least 22 people were killed by gunmen who showed up with explosives. They just shot them down. And many, many people are injured and fighting for their lives in the hospitals right now as we speak.
Didi, let me just ask you a pointed question. The U.S. government has insisted that what is going on here really has nothing to do with sectarian religious jihadist violence. It's just a struggle between farmers and ranchers, herdsmen. What's the truth of the matter as you see it, and why does our government persist in this to the point where they've even removed Nigeria from what's called the country of particular concern list, as it happens shortly before Secretary of State Tony Blinken arrived in country?
Yeah, so in December, Secretary of State Blinken was going to Nigeria. On the eve of that, he took Nigeria off the list of countries of particular concern, which enables the United States to sanction Nigeria and put economic pressure on her to address this reality. We had worked very long and hard for several years to get Nigeria placed on that list. And Secretary Blinken, apparently for political reasons and possibly for the $1 billion military arms sale that just went through earlier this year, has reversed that without any real explanation of why that is. But Nigeria has oil, it has resources, and it's, you know, it's an important ally to the United States. But they're murdering the Christians.
They are. And it will be a less and less of an important ally to the United States as it becomes more and more of a jihadist dominated country and as more and more of this violence takes place. Dee Logason, again, the work that you and our team are doing at Save the Persecuted Christians is indispensable. It's thankless work. And as you say, it often feels as though it's not as effective as we would like it to be. How can people find out more about that work and how they can help, including support it?
You know, it's an honor and a privilege to work on behalf of persecuted Christians. People can find out more at SaveThePersecutedChristians.org. We do webinars on a regular basis, so join us.
With doing everything we can to try to help in this case, specifically by holding the persecutors accountable and penalizing them for what they're doing. That's the raison d'etre of this group. Dee Dee, let me switch gears, switch hats, if you will. You are also a driving force behind the Committee on the Present Danger, China. There are two important webinars coming up in the next few days, and I wanted to give you just a minute or so to introduce those, if you would.
Sure. So on Thursday, we're going to have our regular weekly Committee on the Present Danger, China webinar. This one will focus on the enemies within Biden, Larry Fink, and other CCP-captured elites. We're going to be looking at the elite capture of China, Communist China's unrestricted warfare against America and the free world. That's at 1 p.m. on Thursday, and people can find out more at presentdangerchina.org.
And register then, to participate.
Too. Yes, and register. Please join us. On Monday, our Stop Vax Passports Task Force will be hosting an update to the Digital Gulag. The Digital Gulag at Davos and the WHO, the fight continues. We will have a legal analysis of the WHO's zero draft pandemic treaty and also the continuing fight against the amendments to the international health regulations. And we'll be looking at the WHO and Davos on their trackers that they're
and
putting
the,
in
yes,
place.
Yes, the digital passports and the like that we were just talking about with Dr. Rechtenwald. Dee, thank you so much for all you do. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us with updates if you would. Next up, we're going to speak with Victor Gonzalez, a member of the Spanish Parliament, about the Summit of the Americas. Straight ahead.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last August, Joe Biden failed to deter the Taliban's final assault in Afghanistan. In fact, his conduct and odious orders to the U.S. military to cut and run in the middle of the night, leaving $83 billion worth of advanced weaponry behind, not only assured, but effectively invited the jihadists' victory there and whetted their appetite for more elsewhere. In February, Team Biden once again communicated its unwillingness to impose appreciable costs, this time for a Russian invasion of Ukraine. Vladimir Putin responded, like the Taliban. Now, as communist China prepares for war, the Biden administration is clearing the way for U.S. investors, including federal government employees and military personnel, to put their money in China. It's also easing Trump-era tariffs, further generating revenues that not only signal our provocative weakness, but actually will help pay for China's aggression. Had enough? This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we are joined by phone by an outstanding Spanish parliamentarian by the name of Victor Gonzalez. He has the distinction of being the chairman, or as they call it in the Spanish parliament, the speaker of the Foreign Affairs Committee of his country's legislature. He's taken, of course, as one would expect, a keen interest not only in Spain's domestic interests and politics, but also his country's relationship with others in Europe. But he's also passionate about Latin America and the cause of freedom there, which is now, alas, much in jeopardy. We're speaking with him on the, against the backdrop, I should say, of the Summit of the Americas taking place in Los Angeles this week, and it's a great honor to have him with us. Victor Gonzalez, welcome to Securing America, sir.
Hello, Frank. Really grateful to be able to talk with you once again.
Well, the pleasure is mine, and I just wanted to get perhaps a little bit of background from you as to both how you became deeply knowledgeable about Latin America and sort of your overall assessment of what is happening in the continent south of our border at the moment.
Okay. Just give me some background. I am one of the vice chairmen of Vox, which is the third largest political force in Spain. This is a new political party that started in 2014 and from nothing. And basically, we defend the values and the virtues that we believe are the stronghold of our civilization. I mean, the Western world civilization. The main reason why this political party was initiated by myself and other people is because the traditional conservatives, which will be the Republicans in the U.S., somehow did stop fighting some battles, like the defense of life, frontiers, and so on. We were really worried trying to understand where the world was. What happened is that in Europe, and basically in Spain, we found out we have to carry the fight to the other side of the Atlantic, to America, specifically to Central and Southern America. Because in Spain, the government of Spain nowadays is a coalition of the socialists and the communists. These communists were the guys that did support Maduro with strong ties with the Cuban regime, with Nicaragua. These people were the guys who wrote those new constitutions in all those countries, and they have been financed by the Cuban, by the Venezuelans, and we found out they have been also financed by the Iranians. Mm-hmm. So you cannot win a battle only fighting in one battlefront. No, you need to cover it all. So we decide to go to the other side and look for millions of people that think the way we do. And that's why I have last year more than 17 trips to the other side of the Atlantic. Wow. I just got back last week from participating as an observer in the Colombian elections. And that's the reason. No, in order to fight the 21st century communists or Marxism that has been spreading through all America and even in Europe. No, you have these guys. Sanders was once a member of the founding member of the Follow de Sao Paulo. Follow de Sao Paulo was built by Lula and Fidel Castro when the wall fell apart in 1989. And so they have like 30 years advantage acquiring media, taking place in controlling universities. Mm-hmm. So freedom of speech is at risk. And if I have to summarize all in one, freedom is at risk nowadays. And our duty, as we are living this time, is to fight, as our elders did, fighting for freedom and for the roots and the beliefs I got from my parents, and I want those beliefs to be transferred to my kids.
This is very heartening, needless to say, that you both perceive this threat as we do and are engaged as actively as you are, Victor Gonzalez. Let me ask you, I want to come back to this Forum of Sao Paulo, maybe after a short break, but most immediately, your assessment of what happened in the Colombian elections. These elections, of course, came on the heels of elections in Peru last summer and in Chile last fall, yeah. Both of which resulted in communists coming to power. A communist in Colombia has received the most votes in the first round. There's a runoff coming up, on the 19th of June. Give us your assessment of what's happening in Colombia, a key ally of this country, and I think of the West more generally in South America.
Yeah, I remember that Colombia is the only South American nation that has a privileged association with NATO. So that's give you how important it is for everyone. Yes. What has happened is that Petro, which is the candidate of the Foro de Sao Paulo, a former member of the terrorist group, communist, with close friend of the Castro family, of Chavez, Maduro, on all these communist guys, as you mentioned, got the best results on the first round. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, in the second round, he will not gain power. But it might happen. It might happen. We are really worried because what we are seeing is that all these new communist leaders that are taking over the region, they have access to a huge amount of funds, yeah, that their adversaries are not allowed, cannot manage to compete with them. That's what I show what happened in Peru, in Chile. Right. It did happen in Bolivia, in Honduras, in all these election processes I have been involved to. And they also control the media. It's quite specifically the social media, supported by the Venezuelan people, by the Russians and the Chinese.
And the Chinese. And I want to come back to that with you in just a moment. We have to take a very short break. Parliamentarian Victor Gonzalez of Spain is with us, talking about, the Summit of the Americas and the topics of conversation that should be on the table there right after this. Welcome back. We are talking with a Spanish parliamentarian by the name of Victor Gonzalez. He is a leader in his country's parliament on matters involving foreign affairs of his country, which of course include not just NATO and Europe more generally, but also the wider world. And his particular passion, which I've been impressed by in a meeting I had with him in Washington recently, is for freedom everywhere, and in particular in Spanish-speaking countries like those of Latin America, in which it is very much under assault. And we're talking with him about this in the context of the Summit of the Americas that is taking place right now in the United States in Los Angeles. And Victor, you just touched on a subject that I wanted to make sure we addressed as a sort of segue into the larger challenge posed to us in all of these regards by the Forum of Sao Paulo, namely the role that Communist China is playing in Latin America at the moment through this sort of Communist International, if I think of it as, and more broadly.
What's true is China nowadays is the world leading investment power in the region. Is the first investor in Peru, and we could keep in Salvador, and we could keep counting countries one after the other with few exceptions. It's the same with Argentina, Brazil, and so on. So what the question we need to make ourselves is, do we want those nations to vote internationally in all these supranational organizations what China decides to? Do we believe China is going to be a freedom fighter? Do we believe China is going to fight for human rights? Because Venezuela, but we will go to Ecuador, all these nations own the Chinese billions of dollars. Billions of dollars. And China is investing in those nations. While, for example, the U.S. has basically no presence in Peru. 80 kilometers away from the city of Callao, the Chinese China National Construction Company, if I remember correctly, is building the biggest port in the Pacific coast of South America, right, for a Chinese a mining company, where air carriers will be the size, ships the size of air carriers could be harboring there.
Yeah. It's aircraft something acceptable you're talking for, about.
Yeah. Aircraft carriers. Right. I'm not saying is that on the national design, but that's the how big that construction going on is.
I don't think there's any doubt that the Chinese will try to do that if they can, and they seem to be actually controlling that port under construction right now, of course, which is, again, a worrying sign that it's not just they're sort of in this built out of their Belt and Road Initiative, as they call it, and all the infrastructure that goes along with it, but there really is a military dimension to it. At the very least, there's dual use infrastructure being put into place. So come back to the Forum of Sao Paulo and the role that it is playing in trying to essentially finish off the last democratic, pro-Western, pro-U.S. governments in the hemisphere. Victor Gonzalez.
Yeah, they are doing a marvelous work. Fidel Castro was really worried when the Soviet republics fell, and they start building this, and they have been quite successful. And now they are controlling the majority of the South American nations, and that's a treat for all of us, because when they vote in United Nations or in the World Trade Organization, you know what they're going to vote? They're going to vote against freedom, and our duty is to avoid this expanding. But for example, how well coordinated they are. Do you know that the Black Lives Matter is listed in one of the supporting organizations of the Foro de Sao Paulo? Did you know that Sanders once is among the founding members of the Foro, was a founding member of the Foro de Sao Paulo?
How well interconnected. Senator Bernie Sanders, a communist in the United States Senate.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is this is something that maybe 30 years ago, 40 years ago, we could not think about it, is that the communist now is in our societies. It's in the United States, spread in the society, in the politics, in the media, everywhere. And they have lots of money from the Chinese and the extreme Islamic nations, which are funding these people, which is called my attention that communists and Islamic people are gathering, and the Iranians especially, are gathering together with something, philosophically speaking, is a contradiction, but it's happening.
They have a very different end state in mind, I think it's fair to say, but they are working together
but
to get rid of us.
They have a common goal, which is Western world. It's the one they want to destroy.
Take it down, exactly. You know? So let me just ask you, Victor Gonzalez, we're talking again in the midst of this Latin American, Summit of the Americas, it's called, conclave in Los Angeles. A number of nations have boycotted it over their objections to the fact that certain communist nations, Nicaragua, Cuba, Venezuela, were not invited. The Mexican government, for example, at the presidential level at least, is not coming, and I think others, Honduras, and Guatemala, perhaps for other reasons, Bolivia. What should the agenda for the United States be at this summit, and is that what we're about?
But I think it's common sense. We have been educated in respect, in freedom, and fight able. And I think the regime of Cuba, no one can accept, is not able. It's able, and we have seen what happens. And actually, it's the largest racist government in the world. 7% of the population is black people, and they represent above 60% of people being in prison in Cuba. So I don't know. The calling question, it was Nicaragua, Cuba, Venezuela, all these regimes that don't accept democracy, that are regimes, that are extreme regimes that are bringing hunger and death to their nations.
Poverty.
We should be fighting them in all the levels.
Amen.
Diplomatically speaking, economically speaking, and so on.
Amen.
So
Victor, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I hope that we can get you back on camera at some point soon, if we can, to talk through all of this. Thank you for your insights, as well as the leadership you're exhibiting there in Spain and in our hemisphere as well. Keep it up and come back to us soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, help us protect the country we love, and then go forth and multiply. That was great. Thank you.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.